Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to school to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
Support for this public radio podcast comes from Mellon Financial Corporation, helping financially successful individuals and families protect and maximize their assets through the practice of wealth management, Mellon.com, and by A.G. Edwards, caring for nest eggs for more than 120 years with a commitment to provide objective financial advice. Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, dedicated to a prudent approach to investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Just try to answer that age-old question, what is it that moves the stock market? One of the usual answers is fear of the unknown. It can sink the market like a well-placed torpedo. But we saw today what can happen when you factor out the great unknown. The result can be a record-shattering day on Wall Street. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by The Economist magazine, which tells not only what's happening around the world each week, but why. The Economist, at newsstands, in bookstores, and at economist.com. And by Bank of America, believing that healthy communities and a healthy planet are essential to creating opportunities for everyone. Bank of America, Bank of Opportunity.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Bob Moon in for Kai Ryssdal. We're grateful to have you with us on this Monday, the first day of October, a day that the Dow Jones Industrial Average didn't merely make it back above the 14,000 threshold for the first time since the credit crisis began. It crashed through that psychological barrier and kept right on going to a new all-time closing high of 14,087. Now, it seems fair to ask how that could happen, especially on a day that the world's largest company, Citigroup, announced a huge blow to profits from the housing mess. There were similar dismal warnings from Credit Suisse and UBS. We caught up with Art Hogan in the Boston Trading Center at Jefferies & Company. He's their chief market strategist. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me.
So Citigroup says quarterly profit is going to drop 60%. It's got $5.9 billion in losses, and yet Citigroup stock goes up. The market seems to celebrate. What's going on here?
As early as July, we had a black hole that was an unknown quantity, and that was the damages that were going to be caused by the subprime mortgage debacle and the residential real estate slump. As time comes on and we actually hear from the folks that are holding the risk or taking the losses, it helps us compartmentalize the damage that's been done and actually get a better handle on where we should think pricing should be on a go-forward basis. So we're not celebrating the fact that Citibank had to take large losses, nor are we that UBS or CS also had similar reports that were negative. We're celebrating now that we have concrete knowledge of what's actually going on.
So this is one of those infamous cases where the market is pricing it in or has already priced in the subprime mess?
No, I think it's more of a case of we didn't know the magnitude of the damage created by this subprime debacle. And as we start to know what the damages actually are, when we get a better handle on what we can physically say is the finite damage, the market can then move forward and start focusing on other things.
And yet there was a report from Goldman Sachs today that pointed out that declines in home sales and prices have actually been accelerating. So how do we know that the worst is over here?
Well, we know the worst is over on the credit part of this. We've been through residential real estate slumps before, and we know that those can be long-lived, and I think that's going to be the problem here. This residential real estate bubble, if you will, wasn't created in a couple of months, and it certainly is not going to go away in a couple of months. That's something that's a little more manageable. What our major concern was how much damage was done to the financial portion of the U.S. economy, and how much of that was going to seep over into the broader economy, and was that going to cause a recession? I think the impression that we get today from the numbers coming out of Citibank is the opposite of that. We know what the damages are, but we don't think it's going to cause a recession in the broader economy, and that's something the market wants to celebrate.
We also got word today that manufacturing seemed to lose steam in the past month. That gave rise to some speculation that the Fed might give us another interest rate cut.
I think there's going to be a cut. I don't know if it happens on Halloween or it happens sometime before the end of the year. I think we cut another 25 basis points on both the discount rate and the Fed funds rate and work our way into the first half of next year and see how much traction we get with the original cuts that we've had so far.
Art Hogan is Chief Market Strategist with Jefferies & Company in Boston. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks a lot for having me.
For the record, it probably helped today that former Fed Chief Alan Greenspan added his voice to those saying the credit slump may be ending. Why spend a measly $10 on a road atlas when you can buy the whole mapping company for a little more than $8 billion? The world's largest maker of mobile phones, the Finnish cellular giant Nokia, is apparently navigating its way into the future. Marketplace's Jill Barchet explains.
Navtech keeps track of where all the roads are around the world. It licenses this information to companies that create internet maps, GPS systems for cars, or walking directions. Even Atlas maker Rand McNally buys data from them. Avi Greengard of Current Analysis says Nokia was buying this raw data for its cell phone maps. Now it wants the whole supply chain.
So it would be like McDonald's owning the cows or the land on which the cows graze.
Nokia is the world's largest cell phone maker, but Greengard says it's worried about competition from Apple's iPhone, or maybe even the rumored Google phone. By buying Navtech, Nokia hopes to gain an edge over these new rivals.
They want to be more than just a cell phone company. This is not limited just to mapping data. I mean, in recent months, Nokia has announced an internet portal strategy. They've launched a mobile music store. They've bought a mobile advertising agency.
Carolina Milanese of the Gartner Group predicts that GPS navigation will be one of the fastest-growing add-on services for cell phones.
In Europe, you definitely see an interest from consumers for services around GPS, from navigation to both car and pedestrian to traffic updates and so forth.
Nokia says it will still license Navtech's data. Now that Nokia owns half the market, it could jack up prices. If users like Google decide not to pay, consumers could end up with fewer choices on where to go. In New York, I'm Jill Barchet for Marketplace.
It was the same old song from the music industry in the quarter that just ended. CD sales stink, stank, stunk. Nielsen SoundScan says album sales are down more than 14% over this time last year, and digital sales aren't making up for it. Seems people want to buy individual songs, not whole albums, if they pay for the music at all, that is. Then there's this news from the popular alternative British group Radiohead. Marketplace's Lisa Napoli tells us they're making a key change in their sales strategy.
The band Radiohead says fans can download its new record right from its website and that they can decide how much they want to pay for it.
They're going direct to the consumer. They're cutting out the label, the distributor, the retail store.
That's Brian Zisk of the Future of Music Coalition. Now, this isn't the first time an artist has X'd out the middleman, and some have gone so far as giving away their music for free, like Prince did recently when he stuck his new CD into British newspapers. But NYU professor Aram Sinreich says Radiohead's publicity stunt is the latest indication the music industry's being turned on its ear.
Well, see, the labels are really good at a few things. They're really good at making you famous. But what they're not so good at is actually paying artists.
Sinreich says fewer than 5% of all artists ever see a royalty check beyond the advance they get from record labels. So even if fans pony up a lowball price for this new album, it's likely Radiohead could make even more than it would the old-fashioned way, because it gets to keep all the cash. Music industry veteran Ted Cohen says the group also earns goodwill.
They're not treating their fans as potential criminals. They're treating them as partners.
Music industry lawyer Ken Hertz says the new record is beside the point here.
Music is the best way to sell other stuff.
Like concert tickets and T-shirts, which is where bands really make their money. In Los Angeles, I'm Lisa Napoli for Marketplace.
And speaking of music, Wall Street danced to a new record, as we mentioned, and we'll be breaking out the happy music when we do the numbers. Picture this. South Korea's president leading a motorcade of business leaders across the world's most heavily militarized border. Tomorrow's summit with North Korean leader Kim Jong-il is the second between the two leaders. The eventual goal is a full peace accord to replace the 1953 Korean War ceasefire. Over the years, the South has become a rich democratic nation, and that's drawn as many as 10,000 from the North to take huge risks crossing the border. Adapting to a capitalist society may be less dangerous, but it's no less difficult. Marketplace's Rico Galliano reports from Seoul.
I spoke to Kyungwook Lee 3 months after she defected from North Korea. She asked me not to use her real name and to digitally mask her voice. In her homeland, she was at the top of her field. Here, she doesn't even understand some basic economic concepts, like the difference between income taxes and utility bills.
So you haven't paid taxes yet. Will you owe money this year?
No, actually, I pay taxes every month. I get bills for rent, for the water, TV, telephone. So I think I'm paying taxes every month.
But I'm talking about income taxes. You pay at the end of the year, you have to sort of... How do I explain income taxes?
I tried. She never did quite figure it out. There's a lot she hasn't quite figured out, like how to compare products and prices when she goes shopping. She's afraid to ask for help in the stores because people here don't speak Korean. They speak South Korean.
For example, if I were to buy something which I would call a blouse, the people here use a different term, like shirt. I'm still not comfortable with these words, and I'm still not sure what they are. So basically, I don't go shopping very much.
Recent defectors like Kyungwook need a lot of help navigating South Korea's modern economy, and every year, there are more of them.
We had less than 100 before the year of 1998. Last year, we had over 2,000.
Hee Song-yoon is a government spokesperson at South Korea's consulate in Los Angeles. He says defectors head south to escape famine. Others say northerners are fleeing political persecution. Either way, shortly after arrival in South Korea, every one of them gets whisked off to a 10-week crash course in modern living. But even the government admits it's not enough.
They have some difficulty. And then they usually find that in the market economy system, there is a fierce competition to survive.
Ms. Kim, again, not her real name, defected with a dream of going to beauty school. Instead, she ended up here, a small windowless room in the basement of an office building in Seoul. On a table lie tubes full of microchips the size of her pinky nail. It's her second day of work in South Korea.
So what I do is, I place the tiny chips on this machine, and when the lights turn green, it means they've been programmed.
Chips go in machine, chips go in a tube. For this, she'll earn $1,300 a month, 20% less than the average South Korean salary. She says she's grateful for the money, but she's surprised, in a country so advanced, that this kind of manual labor still exists. Many defectors arrive with high expectations. Kyungwook Lee did.
I thought South Korea would be heaven. I thought once you got here, the government would give me a house, a car, and enough money to assure a certain quality of life. That's what I was told. But after I came, I discovered that was not true.
It's an old story. Immigrants find their new country's streets aren't paved with gold. But once upon a time, South Korea's government did reward defectors with jobs and free homes. Andrei Langkov teaches North Korean history at Kukmin University in Seoul.
During the Cold War, these people were indeed very useful. They were living proof of their superiority over the godless communist system. However, these people are increasingly seen as a kind of drain on the South Korean resources and social security budget.
Is that true?
To a very small extent.
South Korea still gives each defector a minimum of $10,000 in aid, plus low-cost housing and job incentives. Defectors say it's not enough to really pay the bills in one of the most expensive countries on earth, but it is enough to make some South Koreans resentful. Eran Lee defected 10 years ago.
Back then, people were fascinated with the defectors. Now that more are coming, they're more likely to think, don't we have to pay more taxes because of the North Koreans? It'd be okay if the defectors came here and were able to adjust very quickly. But that's not the case.
It takes years, but most defectors do adapt. But Kukmin University's Andrei Langkov worries eventually Korea won't be able to afford to wait for northerners to adjust.
Sooner or later, unification will come. There will be millions of North Koreans coming to the South and will have the same problems, but multiplied by many, many thousands.
In Seoul, I'm Rico Galliano for Marketplace.
Here's something that might make your ears perk up. Starbucks is now a family destination, or so the company says. It might soon be brewing up menu items targeted directly to kids and teens. Right now, teens indulge in 24-ounce frappuccinos that pack more than three times the caffeine punch of a can of Coke. So is Starbucks truly interested in decaffeinating its younger customers? Either way, commentator and humorist Tim Bador worries that insufferable teens might overrun his beloved coffee house.
For a few decades now, we've been medicating our kids to deal with ADD or hyperactivity in order to smooth out their behavior. And to help in that effort, Starbucks is going to start marketing coffee to teenagers. Actually, Starbucks said they are just reviewing their policy of not marketing to kids and will toss around the idea of adding new drinks and kid flavors and sizes. Translation? 6 months from now, you will be hearing, "Try our new bubblegum-flavored coffee in either Ventilicious or Hannah Montana Grande Rama sizes." On the one hand, I like the idea of American teens being exposed to the cafe lifestyle, the art of conversation, and consuming a product made for a specific person by a specific person in real time and in the same space. I like the idea of American kids growing up with an appreciation for quality. Why? Because I've been to too many birthday parties at Chuck E. Cheese. My fear, though, is that already naturally amped up eighth graders will invade America's serene, relaxed library-like coffee emporiums, get on caffeine jags, and speed blather about their junior romances or Zac Efron or pester the clerk over why Starbucks is out of the Britney Spears Live from Folsom Prison CD. And I don't know about you, but I would rather watch preteens play at Chuck E. Cheese than listen to teenagers talk in my coffee house, which is why I believe in big government. We regulate the ADD medicines we give our kids and alcohol, tobacco, why not caffeine? And more importantly, teenagers in large groups are annoying. Someone, the Justice Department, or even the military, must force at gunpoint if necessary. Starbucks, if they want to sell coffee to teens, to open entirely new stores like the Gap did with Baby Gap, called Jittery Teen Bucks or Teens on Beans or whatever, and thus protect parents and the public at large from a full frontal teen assault. Isn't that why we have big government in the first place?
For more of Tim Bador's funny stuff, go to marketplace.org and you can click on Contact to tell us what you think. Coming up, a new taste for Subway.
People are psyched. I constantly get emails and calls every day.
All day. About 20 phone calls a day.
Minimum.
But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials burst across the finish line at 14,087, setting a new record as investors figured the worst of the credit squeeze may be history. The Dow pulled up 191 points, a gain of more than 1.3%. The Nasdaq sprinted up 39 points, or 1.4%, to end at 2740. The S&P 500 jumped 20 points, or 1.3%, to close at 1547. All it took was a comment from Citigroup that the home building industry's steep decline this year made those companies a bargain. Lennar added on 2.75%. D.R. Horton built up 5%. Pulte Homes upgraded 8.75%. Countrywide Financial, the largest U.S. mortgage company, juiced up 5%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments. Today, Putnam manages money for more than 9 million individual and institutional investors worldwide. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. And by Angie's List, providing thousands of reports on local service companies. Details at 888-944-LIST and angieslist.com. Science and technology reports are supported by Boston Scientific, committed to delivering what's next in medical technology to help clinicians improve and extend lives. BostonScientific.com. Ever hear a song on Marketplace, but you just can't place it? Or maybe it's the first time you've heard it and you want to hear it again. Just click on the archive section of our website. We list the songs we play on every show in that day's rundown. There's even a link to an online store where you can buy the song and help fund public radio programming. It's all at marketplace.org.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here are events for Tuesday, October 2nd. The presidents of the United States and Iraq will meet. The House holds a hearing on the digital future of the United States and competition in the telecommunication industry. And on this day in history, 1869, India's leader of passive resistance, Gandhi, was born. I'm Alex Schmidt.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Bob Moon in for Kai Ryssdal. It's the first Monday in October, and as always, the U.S. Supreme Court began another term of hearing cases. In the past year, business interests have fared very well in the decisions handed down by the court, newly led by Chief Justice John Roberts. Remember, Roberts was a lawyer for big businesses before he became a federal judge. Will that business-friendly record continue? Marketplace's John Dimsdale reports several cases will be putting that question to the test.
Not only with its rulings, but also with the cases it decides not to hear. This Supreme Court is inclined to set a high bar for legal appeals from employees, shareholders, and competitors who feel wronged by businesses.
Last year, the Supreme Court threw a lot of cases that they viewed as meritless out of court.
That's Akin Gump partner Tom Goldstein, who writes for SCOTUS blog. He says one case the court has accepted this term will decide whether stock owners who feel cheated can sue the accountants and bankers and lawyers who are accused of either contributing to or turning a blind eye to corporate fraud.
This case comes to the Supreme Court with the stench of Enron on it, because that's what everybody has in mind, massive securities fraud that caused people to lose their pensions. On the other hand, there are a lot of people who are concerned that this could create debilitating potential liability that would cause people just not to advise companies for fear of securities fraud suits.
The court has accepted a half dozen cases dealing with labor and employment law. Three of them involve age discrimination. One will decide whether a boss's retaliation against a worker who complained about discrimination is just another case of discrimination. But what strikes Virginia Seitz, a partner with Sidley Austin, is that so far there are no union-related cases.
The court's docket symbolizes the state of the American economy. What are the big disputes in the workplace right now? And they are disputes about federal statutory rights, as opposed to disputes about enforcement of collective bargaining agreements. And that's just because there aren't as many workplaces where there is a union on the site.
The AFL-CIO declined comment on this year's Supreme Court case schedule. The court will also wade into patent law protections for technology companies. Marcia Coyle, the Supreme Court correspondent for the National Law Journal, says this case, too, reflects changes in the economy.
As you know, as our manufacturing industry has declined, intellectual property is seen as sort of the engine of our economy, and many businesses have been unhappy with how the lower courts have been dealing with issues affecting patents, trademarks, copyrights.
And the court this term will also decide whether state or federal governments have the right to regulate internet sales of tobacco across state lines, and whether an injured patient can sue in state court if a defective medical device was approved by the Food and Drug Administration. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
A whole lot of people are eating fresh these days. Subway has more restaurants than any other fast food chain in the country. Of course, those 21,000 locations can make it tough to keep growing, so Subway is finding new markets overseas.
Das Chicken Teriyaki Sandwich. Fresh, fresh, fresh. Come to Subway. Eat fresh.
Didn't know they say eat fresh the same way in German. Aside from expanding across the sea, the chain is trying to sandwich in some new growth here at home. Stacey Vanek-Smith takes a look at a kosher Subway that's opening this week right here in Los Angeles.
It was Friends and Family Day at LA's newest Subway yesterday. The restaurant was packed with people from the mainly Jewish neighborhood. It was 21-year-old Maxine's first meat sub.
I had a whole wheat pastrami sandwich toasted. It was excellent. Like, really, it was like melting in my mouth. It was amazing.
Keeping kosher means no pork and no mixing meat and dairy, so no cheese on the subs here. 26-year-old owner Jonathan Sedegat says he got bored with the kosher restaurants in his neighborhood, so he teamed up with his friend, 25-year-old Sammy Aflalo, Aflalo says the Orthodox community is a strong, untapped market.
All these Orthodox people, all the kids, they all watch the same, you know, TV programs as everybody else, but their whole life they can't eat here.
Opening a specialty Subway has some unique challenges. Aflalo and Sedegat had to find special meat. They invested in a sink so customers could wash up and say a prayer before eating. And then there were all the approvals.
Everything not only has to be certified by Subway, but more importantly also by Kahila, which is our Kashrut, our certification company. So every product from every sauce to the meat has to be approved by them.
Those approvals cost money, and that special meat costs about 3 times more than the meat other Subways use. That means the sandwiches at the kosher Subway are a couple bucks more than they are at regular restaurants. But Sedegat and Aflalo expect their customers will be quite happy to shell out a little extra for a kosher sub.
People are psyched. I constantly get emails and calls every day.
All day. About 20 phone calls a day.
Minimum.
This isn't Subway's only kosher restaurant. The first one opened last year in Cleveland, and there are 2 more in New York. Thomas Koba is the chief operations officer for Subway. He says the company has also launched halal locations in New Jersey.
We're able to attract more customers that maybe we wouldn't have gotten if we didn't make the modifications.
Koba says tapping into minority markets is a great way to expand Subway's brand inside the U.S., and he says it's good experience for overseas growth.
This gives us an additional advantage when we can modify our menu and know that we have acceptability of the product. It's something that will really play out in our growth over in other countries.
It's certainly a win-win for Subway, says food consultant Ron Paul. He says franchisees take on all the financial risk, and Subway can tap their knowledge of local markets.
In order to maintain good franchisee relations, you have to be willing to try ideas that they have.
Like a shawarma sub. That's an innovation Aflalo and Sedegat are offering at their franchise. Other fast food companies don't seem to be following Subway's lead just yet, but COO Thomas Koba expects the competition will likely want to take a bite out of a market that Jewish authorities say is worth as much as $100 billion. Koba says Subway's kosher restaurants are thriving, and maybe not just because of the food.
It's a great place to meet people and to find a husband.
A kosher husband.
In Los Angeles, I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, where a mix of large U.S. companies can strengthen your portfolio. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication.
This final note, the gender wage gap has been a thorn in the side of plenty of big companies. Lawsuits against the likes of Goodyear may finally get salaries evened out, but those companies may now have another incentive to pony up, higher profits. A study out today shows that among the 500 largest American companies, those with the highest number of women on their boards outperform those with fewer. In return on equity, companies with the most women beat out the less diverse competition by 53%. In return on invested capital, the number was 66%. And that's Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow rocketed up 191 points, 1.3%, setting a new record. The Nasdaq gained 39 points, 1.4%, and the S&P 500 jumped 20 points, 1.3%. Our producers include Caitlin Carroll, Jennifer Collins, Megan Larson, and Fiona Eng. Marketplace was created by Jim Russell. Next time on the program, tension builds over wartime wage gaps.
It even got to the point where civilians were ordered not to disclose to military personnel how much they are being paid.
I'm Bob Moon. Thanks for being with us. Kai's back tomorrow.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money.
Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college accountant? How does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox, and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.